and welcome to Science Chat, the science communication podcast. I'm Sean Marshall. In my continuing mission to look at what's happening in the science world from a science communication perspective, the controversy of Baroness Susan Greenfield being made redundant from her post as director of the Royal Institution was bound to be of interest. And in this episode, I chatted about this Sue Blackmore, freelance writer and occasional Guardian columnist, who has reported on the controversy. Sue, you suggested in an article published after Baroness Greenfield's redundancy that in your opinion she achieved her post as director without any significant scientific research. How do you think that she was able to do this, and why would the Royal Institution prefer someone like that to a scientist with many years of significant research behind them?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I did imply that. What I was trying to say in that article was to give an opinion about the person everyone was arguing about, which is that she is not... You know, it's understandable why people have not wanted her to be a fellow of the Royal Society and those kinds of things, because she's not a top-notch scientist who's done fantastic research. Even worse, she has actually promoted ideas in her lectures and articles and so on, which there's precious little, if any, backing for. I wanted to make those things clear. Now, I think that's a separate issue from a particular job. I don't know what the Royal Institution wanted when they were looking for a leader for it. They could well have been wanting someone flamboyant, somebody in the news all the time, somebody who could really make a big public fuss about science. They might have particularly wanted a woman because there'd never been one. There were fewer women than many would say there should be in science, and maybe it would help to have a woman at helm. I do not know what their motives were.
And do you think that after they took her on in that position, when she started to be somebody who didn't seem to have the same type of values about science as many scientists would, and that she made a lot of high-profile pronouncements, why would you think that they allowed her to remain in that position for such a long time, for more than 10 years?
I can't answer questions about other people's motives, about what they wanted. I could only speculate like anybody else. I don't know, because I wasn't there, how good she was at doing her job and at running the place. Now, I know she had huge ambitions for it. I think they were probably unrealistic. I mean, for example, making a really fancy, expensive bar and restaurant there. The idea is wonderful. You know, wouldn't that be lovely if you had a place in London where scientists would all kind of gravitate and you could recognize them an evening, you could turn up there and there'd be really interesting people sitting around. But most scientists, you know, we're all so unbelievably busy and bowed down with a billion things to do, and probably wouldn't have the time anyway, but also wouldn't have the money. I mean, on the whole, scientists are not wealthy and don't want fancy bars. They, you know, they love meeting other scientists and talking, but, you know, maybe it misfired from that point of view. So I think the ambitions were exceedingly ambitious for a scientific institution. But I wasn't there. I wasn't in charge of money. I wasn't involved. So, you know, I'm only speculating from the outside.
And do you think that these type of roles are more likely to be sought by somebody who wants a high-profile position rather than actually sought by the scientists?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's right. I mean, yes. Susan Greenfield was always very ambitious, wanted to be in the public position and wanted to be known about, and she succeeded in that. And I think to some extent you need somebody like that at the top of such an organisation. I mean, you certainly don't want to put one of your, from the point of view of either our country or of the world or the progress of science, you don't want to go and put your absolute top research scientist in a job like that. You want them to be doing top research, don't you? I mean, you know, the really, really, really good people need to be given the money and flexibility and space to get on with their research and not be tied down with some great admin job. Now, that's a huge admin job. What you need for that is somebody who is really competent at that kind of leadership role, who has good vision and has good ideas and can see them through. You don't necessarily need an absolute top scientist, but I think you do need somebody whose science is good enough and whose use of science is good enough to set an example, and that is perhaps where we should say that she fell short, because she did not set a good example in terms of truth and honesty and openness in scientific communication, and that's what I was talking about in that article.
But isn't there an inherent problem there, that the people that you would want to do the job wouldn't want to have the job,
And it's the phrase that I put on it is, it's like those who can research and those who can't talk about it. And if a job like that, which is so important, seems to attract the people who just want the profile rather than the people who might be best suited for it, would you not actually be better to have somebody who had, you know, very little science background but who was just a very capable administrator?
No, because you get this argument all the time in the media, and that is so frustrating. It's slightly different argument, but the same general gist, but along the lines of, oh well, you know, the listener, if it is Radio 4, or the viewer, if it is TV, it doesn't know about all this stuff. So we need someone to present it who doesn't know either, and speak for the voice of the rubbish. If you don't understand the way science works, if you've never worked as a scientist yourself, it is extremely difficult to understand what's going on inside, what's important, why the scientists are talking the way they are, what are the interesting issues to organise your lectures around, so on. No, I don't think that at all. Of course, there are some organisations that's true for, but I mean, we are talking here about your own institution, and I think you do need, ideally, as I said, you don't want to take your absolute top research scientists out of doing their research, because that's what they want to do and that's what they should be doing, but you need really good scientists, you know, next level scientists who are really good, but who actually want a phase in their life of doing a job like this. Now, plenty of people like that around. The same kind of people who would do those sorts of jobs in university science departments. The kind of people who, you know, will be the dean or, you know, run a huge science department in the university. They usually are very good scientists themselves, but not the top-notch ones. Or else they've done their decades of top-notch research and they now want to do something else. There are lots and lots of different kinds of mixtures that you can get, but I certainly don't think that the one institution will be served by having non-scientists trying to lead it. No way.
Okay, leaving aside for obvious reasons the legal action that the Baroness is taking against the Royal Institution, did you think it was interesting that some members tried to oust the Governing Council recently? Do you think that maybe they were just trying to set a mechanism in place whereby the Baroness could end up back in the same job?
Oh, I think so. That's certainly how it looked. I do not know how the whole thing started. She claims not to have been behind it. But I do know that on the list of the people who started it were some of her close friends. It looks from the outside as though they wanted to find a way to put her back in post. But they haven't succeeded. She has claimed that all sorts of unfair things went on. It's very hard to tell. There was an organisation they demanded to have, as they were entitled to do within the rules of the organisation, to have a special meeting to discuss these changes, and they were overwhelmingly voted down. It looked to me as though that's the end of it, but we shall see.
I guess a lot of it will come out in the legal action that the Baroness is taking against the Royal Institution anyway.
Yes, I do not understand this. I mean, at one stage she said she was going to make a claim on sex discrimination grounds. Now, that is extremely peculiar. You know, she had the enormous honour of being the first woman ever to be appointed to that illustrious post. Is that sex discrimination in her favour, or was that nothing to do with her sex? I really don't know. But to claim that her sex had something to do with her losing the job, it seems exceedingly odd to me. I can't imagine that she could succeed on those grounds. And they're looking dark to go ahead, but I don't know. Again, we shall see. Very interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. One of the other things that I picked up in the article that you wrote was that you believe that she might be an example of a woman having to fight harder than a man to achieve such a goal, and by that was someone who was the architect of her own fate. Do you mean that when she got there she tried too hard?
Yes, it's a difficult world for women in many areas still. I mean, we've made huge progress during my lifetime, but there are still few women at the top of all sorts of things, and I think one of the reasons for that is that by and large women don't want to fight in the same way as men. They don't want to get into all the hierarchical, you know, organisational stuff. I think I'm an example of that. I just don't have any appetite for it, you know, and a lot of women are like that, and she doesn't have children, and I have children, and many women scientists who have children actually want to spend quite a lot of time with their children as well as with their science, and that you don't get to the top and get those sorts of jobs if you have those desires in life. And she has deliberately not wanted to have children and wanted to go for the big time. Now to do that, you've got to be a fighter, and you've got to get in there and do all that ladder climbing stuff, and she's done that. Now, I can't know what her motives were. I can't know how the people around her treated her. But just going from the institutions I do know about, it often happens that women just have to fight incredibly hard when they have chosen to take that path, which is mostly full of men. And it's not easy to take on, to be the first woman in a post like that. You're proving a whole lot of things apart from yourself. You're kind of proving a woman can do this, as well. So I think it's quite tough, and she did fight exceedingly hard. Yeah. She was always very, very ambitious and wanted those kinds of jobs, and you have to fight very hard if you want those kinds of jobs. And that isn't always, that's certainly not always the advantage of science, obviously.
And do you think there's any possibility that maybe, the fact that she had to fight so hard to get that job, that as part of that fighting, she antagonized enough people in certain positions that eventually it came back to haunt her, that they eventually looked for any reason they could to actually get her removed from the position?
She has unquestionably antagonized huge numbers of people. Whether that happened in that case, I do not know.
Well, finally, I just wanted to briefly talk about another article that you had published in The Guardian. It was in last month, about science and spin. And I was just wondering if you think that spin is ever justified, particularly when a scientist may believe that the public will not be able to understand the uncertainty that frames their particular data. In other words, if you have data of which a great part of it proves something that you know to be right or that you believe to be right, but of which a small portion seems to contradict, and you know that that small portion, if it's something controversial like GM foods or if it's something like climate change data, if you're worried that that small portion might be reported out of context and then can be used by those who oppose your theory, do you think that it's ever right to exclude that data and to spin things only in a positive way?
I don't think it's right. I think it's understandable. I think scientists nowadays are in a very difficult position that they weren't in 20 years ago, even probably 10 years ago, because scientific information now is so widely available. If you publish a paper, in a peer-reviewed journal, everybody can go and see it now relatively easily. Going back to the first part of your question, I would say this. In a way, you can never not spin. It depends what you mean by spin. If you do any kind of scientific research, any kind at all, usually you collect so much data and do lots of analyses that you can't publish everything. You have to select. And the way you do that selection is absolutely critical. It should be fair and open and honest and give a fair picture of the results. And I hope that that's what most scientists do in academic papers. But, even then there is selection because, you often find something you didn't expect to find. Well, obviously, if it's a really interesting thing, you're going to give some space to that. And then if a whole lot of things just don't turn out right, well, you give a very... didn't turn out like you expected, or we don't have any indications for the hypothesis you're testing or whatever, you're going to give less space to them. But, they should still be there, it should be done fairly and so on. Now, where does it merge from that into spin, where you deliberately try and give an impression? In a way, I'd like to say it's never justified, but then you hear again and again on the news, you get incompetent or devious interviewers dragging stuff out of scientists and then using them out of context. I think we're living in very different times. I think this is something that we need big discussions about and public education to understand better, but it's terribly hard. A lot of it comes down to probability. So, for example, when the weather forecast is said, well, there's a 60% chance of a barbecue summer or whatever it was, and then it gets into the news, well, it's definitely going to be a barbecue summer, then it isn't, and everyone goes, they went wrong. We need a better public education on just coping with probabilities. I don't know how we do that. In the States, to some extent, they've done it with weather forecasts because they've publicised probabilities for a long time. And maybe that's what we have to do, just everybody used to thinking probabilities. But when, you know, scientists are saying it's 97.9% probability that the global warming is man-made, I mean, you know, these kinds of things, people just don't know what to do with it. I think probably my answer is spin in the political sense is never justified, but it's not a black and white issue at all.
Okay, and on that note, thank you very much, Sue.
You're very welcome.
Well, that's it for this episode of Science Chat. As usual, you can contact me through my blog, www.sciencechat.net/wordpress. Till next time.